fascinating.
Let's go back to the beginning. I was a working class child. My father was a postman. Had a scholarship at a public school, better school, and had a scholarship in classics to Oxford. Now, classics was accidental because my best subject at school was mathematics. But the headmaster was short of classicists, so I was forced to do classics instead, which in fact was very good for me, otherwise I'd be a very narrow mathematician, I think. But my interest is still very much scientific and numerical. But in addition to this, as a personal history, I had a very bad stammer from the age of 3 to about 23, and it made me rather withdrawn and shy, obviously, because you can't communicate with people. I thought of myself as a born introvert. Also, my mother died when I was 8, which probably made me feel insecure as well. And so when I went up to Oxford, I didn't feel at all sure of myself or who I was. And it took me some time to find out. I found out some at Oxford, some later. Anyway, I started working. I thought of becoming a lecturer, but then with a stammer, I thought I couldn't. So I started taking a menial job at the Bodleian Library and started doing a DPhil on, of all things, an 8th century manuscript of Boethius, I think it was, with Anglo-Saxon gloss in the margin, because I had equal qualifications as Anglo-Saxon classics. I got bored on my mind with this, interested in the library side a bit. I went from there to Glasgow University Library, and by this time I'd forgotten about being a lecturer, and my stammer went. Maybe marrying my wife helped. It gradually went. I was.
So you had no special treatment for that? It just disappeared?
I had treatment when I was about 17, but it didn't have any effect at the time. It just taught me to relax, which has been useful since. But it just went. It comes back occasionally, but I forget about it. I suddenly discovered I wasn't introverted at all. I was quite buoyant and aggressive and extrovert, and things went on from there. But then things took another dip, because I went to South Africa University Library, where there's a mad librarian. And she really was, I can say this now, she's dead. We wished her dead many times. Miss Henderson, Marjorie Henderson. She drifted into the job during the war when it was very small and said never really wanted it. But she was an absolute bitch of the unspeakable order. She was really unspeakable. And we didn't communicate with her except by memo. We hardly ever saw her. There are some amusing moments. For example, I remember sitting in a meeting once. One of my colleagues, Alec Hansen, who went to Harry Boyle University, had his legs crossed. Mr. Hansen, what do you mean I'm not crossing your legs? I can see your knee above the table. You know, it's like I'm working in the madhouse. Anyway, to our great astonishment and surprise, she retired at the age of 55, having worn herself out by antagonizing everybody else in the university. And we couldn't hold our straight our joy. We didn't show it to manifest at home. By this time, I was, 32? She succeeded by Berries Bland from Birmingham University, whom I owe my career to, in a sense. He wasn't a dynamic boss, he had no ideas, he wasn't a good speaker, he never wrote anything, he never contributed to information science at all. He was a fantastic boss. Why? Because he enabled us before that word came into management use. He gave us freedom, he gave us our head. He coordinated, he was a real chairman, a leader, and I came absolutely alive then, we all did, but I think it affected me most of all, positively shot up in the library, and we started, this was the days when automation began to come in, and I went into that like a duck into water, partly because we're interested in mathematics in the past, I suppose.
System studies too.
System studies.
Were you involved in system studies?
I got involved in them as well, yes. We started, we did one of the first studies of student attitudes to the library, where I taught myself a certain amount of statistics, and got involved in, I started writing, and discovered I wasn't too bad at it, and inevitably when you start writing, you start speaking, people ask you to talk. I discovered I wasn't bad at that either. And then I went as a deputy to Newcastle, where automation was really taking off. We automated the acquisition system, the first automated acquisition system anywhere in Britain. And we automated the catalogue as well. Could have been done better, but it was done anyway.
But these were in-house systems, I take it?
In-house systems. In-house systems, they're all done in-house. A man named Nigel Cox did all the work on it. He recently died, actually. He wasn't in the library and computer department. I was virtually running Newcastle. I was only deputy there, but the librarian was a lady son and everything at all, so I had to run the library, otherwise nothing would happen at all. And so I really got interested in management there, how to motivate staff, how to give them freedom. Had two old ladies in the acquisition department. I thought, my God, how am I going to get them to automate? But I said, well, what's wrong with the present system? How can we improve it? And so they specified, what would you really like to do? So I think automation can help you do that. And so we loved each other after about 3 or 4 months of this, you know. And I never had any problems whatever. They're both over 60. And they're fantastic ladies. It was marvellous. And then I went to Bath University where I had a free hand. Because in ex-technology universities, as they were, ex-CATs, the running of the library left librarians, academics didn't tell you what to do.
CATs are?
College of Arts Technology. They're not quite universities, but more than colleges. It was one of the, about nine at the time, Michigan universities, and I just went there when it became a university. And again, we automated the catalogue, and I learned more about management, and we did a lot of things there. We started the catalogue research, which ended in the library management, library, what's it called? Morgan Dempsey's been running, he's just retired from it, he's left to go to another job. But the really catalogue systems, a series of cataloguing systems which last over 20 years.
These were the
based at Bath. And they developed after while I started, but I don't claim much credit, I merely got them started. They developed under Philip Bryant and then Morgan Dempsey. But they've done a tremendous job and triggered that off. And then I went to the National Central Library, and from there, in its closing days, and went to Boston Spa, because I had sympathy with what Erica was doing, and took over from his reins. I hadn't studied Erica for a year, they succeeded him. We already had a research unit there, I increased that, and we did a lot of studies of use and comparing with citations and so on, and distributions, and I asked to do a piece of obsolescence for JDoc, which I did with Sanderson, and then Science Reference Library, which has become a classic in the obsolescence work.
So, Morris, I think,
working under Marge Henderson at Southampton, I realised that what she was doing wasn't what people wanted, the library's almost unusable. So I thought, well, looking at life from a user's point, how do you design it? So I began thinking, how do you design libraries around users, not redesign people to fit libraries? And that's affected my career, my whole thinking has been based on this. Also, I try to unify the highly statistical, methodical thinking, systematic thinking, using every piece of technology and statistical equipment available to serve users. So integrating the human, if you like, with the theoretical.
It's interesting that that sort of idea is now animating the development of the computer-based system in a way that it did not before.
Absolutely. Well, I wrote a piece of the proceedings, again, about a couple of years ago, on designing what I want for the library, how to design libraries around users. And the same applies to computer systems, but it's motivated nearly all my thinking since. So on the one side, the technical, statistical, on the other side, the social, serving people. Finding out how people work, what they want, what they think. And that motivated a lot of the social science studies because I was not satisfied that much of what applied to sciences applied to social sciences. They were getting left out in the cold. And so I got a grant from Austin, as it was then, to do this series of studies on social scientists' need, not only researchers, also practitioners.
So you have trouble getting the grant from Austin because this would be quite new. There would be one that worked on the sciences.
Well, I didn't have much trouble because it was so new and there were no competitors. So I didn't have much trouble getting on. And then this developed into this is the design of racism and social science. There's a lot more studies, including studies of citations before they're all automated. If you follow each end out, we can do this all manually.
And punch cards?
Yeah, well, they're punch cards, yeah. And this produced some interesting material on how social sciences relate to each other, how they're dependent on each other. For example, anthropology is highly dependent on economics, psychology and everything else, but economics is almost self-sufficient. It may in fact be a sort of sign of maturity of a science that becomes more self-dependent. On the other hand, it may be a sign that boundaries are breaking down, as is in physics and chemistry, and they're getting more integrated.
Yeah.
But you can read all kinds of things into this. Out of this, I made some practical proposals which were taken up.
Remind us of what they were.
Well, really, designing social science information systems to serve people. For example, one study we did was into the optimal pattern of frequency and coverage. Because if you produce something once a week, it's going to be too thin. People are going to know why you're asking on the side of the community. If you produce it once every 3 months, it's going to be too big. They're not using it because it's too big. So what's the optimal pattern? And we made some, we did some practical operational research studies on that. Bill Arms actually did those, as you know, of course. Do you know Bill Arms?
No. Bill Arms?
Do you know William Y. Arms?
No.
He, put off a
I don't know that being a professor of computer science at Cornell was sideline was.
Well, I think it's one of his jobs, actually. He's a professor there, but I think it's not his main job, actually.
Mm.
I don't think it was. Last time he contacted me. We keep in touch, but,
So he helped you with the...
Well, he did the operational research part of that.
Mm.
Which I will obviously have favoured, because I've seen value a whole lot.
Mm.
Anyway, there's some practical proposals there which weren't used. But also, the whole question of, there are far too many so-called abstract indexing journals. There's a lot of overlap, but we found they had to use about five or six to get reasonable coverage, in 90% coverage, unlike sciences where you've got the huge ones like Chemabs and so on. And what they ought to have done really is to amalgamate, integrate, coordinate, or whatever. None of this happened, of course. Some of them were hand-to-mouth things, shoestring efforts. Some were very big ones, by certified abstracts, but they never held a lot. And they're still a very efficient system.
Is this related to psychabs and sociological abstracts, historical abstracts too?
History is on the road of social science, far as we're concerned. But there are three or four London ones we've got.
Mm.
I'm out of touch for this, but the situation is still bad.
Mm. So back then, as a result of these studies, you made some proposals that, they might change coverage and so on. These were not taken up. Let's not talk about one.
The only way of getting them taken up actually was for a public sector body or one, a not-for-profit organisation, to outdo them. You weren't going to get the existing ones to amalgamate, but you could have one that started a new one, resourcing or dancing and not rest out of existence. The only way it could have happened.
A bit unrealistic because of the competition with the... I mean, if you take things like PsychAds and the professional societies that are supporting journals of that kind, it's very hard to...
There's nothing economics parallel with those.
Say again?
Nothing economics or sociology parallel with the American Psychological Association, whatever it is, or the...
Well, sociological abstracts too, I think, is...
Nothing like the size of the science project.
It's fairly well established, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, it's interesting that right then, I mean, that in a sense there was this competitiveness that wouldn't allow them to come together in some reasonable.
Well, they're making a profit, albeit a small one. Mm. They're either making a profit and didn't want to drop it, or there were lectures doing it on an Alice Houston at the university. They're making no profit because they're running kudos.
Mm.
Either way, you weren't going to get them giving it up.
Mm.
And then until they retired or had to.
Mm. So,
there's nothing in anthropology economics parallel to the American Psychological Society or Biological Association and so on, ACS and so on, nothing parallel to that at all. If there had been, I think they could have done something
about it. So, these studies then, you did the INPRO studies and then the DIS study, one following the other in a sense, naturally. And at what point then did you left Bath?
Well, INVOS started at Bath. It was finished off when I was at Boston Spa.
Oh, was it? Okay.
And it overlapped a bit with DISIS, which also... Now, INVOS, I got the grant at Newcastle, that's right. We started at Newcastle. And more or less finished at Bath. And DISIS started a little bit of overlap. DISIS started at Bath and finished 3 or 4 years into my Boston Spa time.
Okay.
At that time, I was much too busy doing other things to pursue it.
Did you have somebody that could take over that role?
Well, Mike Britton, of course, was the first primary researcher on DISIS, who's now in New Zealand.
Yeah, Mike. Yes, and he was, he was physically located at Bath.
Yeah, right. It's really what made his career.
Yeah.
Because he was a psychology lecturer, so that's when I pulled him in.
Mm. Mm. Yes, he did that book on, which is a survey of the literature centre.
That's right, And he's done one or two books on it.
Yeah. Okay.
But he really owes his whole career to that beginning. One of my great joys in the career is seeing other people develop.
Mm.
Like Philip Bryan, for example, was a rather shy, awkward, slightly gauche, non-graduate, inexperienced ex-public librarian at Bath. He really came into his own completely. I mean, he's made a different man entirely. But he wants to catalogue his own thing.
Well, he then made his reputation as a consequence of seeing William.
Exactly.
Because of his
anyone says that, I mean, he has a license to say this in public all the time. It's very satisfying to see people grow. And there's a bottle of Boston Spa over 1,000 stars under me in the British Library. I knew about 300 by forename. But watching some of them grow and helping them grow without them knowing it, I think, in most cases, you know, it was very satisfying.
Tell me something about Urquhart and your association with him and eventually following him into that position as director.
He had a one-track mind. I mean, he was a most uninteresting man. He could talk about almost nothing. Except for those of Boston Spa, a great egotist. I mean, his achievement there, he wrote these two books, which are not actually good. I was asked to referee one of them for an American publisher. I said, in fairness to Urquhart, please don't publish it. It won't do any good. I mean, Benzema's used them quite a bit for his work. There's some good stuff in them, but they're so egotistic all the time. You know, I did this, I did that. He was a big bully. He appointed lots of yes men. And when I became boss, I had my first staff meeting. And they sat there and I said, well, I want your opinion. So we're waiting for yours. And I said, well, I'm not Urquhart, so I'm on his line. I want yours, you're being well paid. We're going to work together. I'm not going to boss you around. And some of them never learned. Some of them just couldn't. And some of them really burst out in a great. But some of them, including my deputy Keith Barr, who died 2 years ago, he just couldn't change. He was a marvellous deputy in the sense whatever you asked him to do, he'd do it superbly. But never a spark on his own, not a spark initiative. Also no human warmth either. Very interesting. But it's very interesting because I had two jobs. One, making Boston Spa humane, and it couldn't have lasted as Urquhart was running it. He ran like a dictatorship. Unions were getting restless. Staff were changing, attitudes were changing. It couldn't have lasted as he was running it. But the other main task was integrating the National Central Library and the NLL with totally different traditions. And that was interesting too.
But your coming from the National Central Library must have been a great help in that respect.
It was a help, yes. I understood both sides. And I gave support, not too much support, to the National Central Library staff. Many of them stayed behind in London, so not all that many came up, actually. But those that did, some still did do it too. But it wasn't the people slash the traditions, getting two cultures going together. I reckon in a year we cracked it, in 2 years, and no problem at all. Mm. It was seamless.
Well, when Urquhart set it up, I mean, it was really very much a kind of factory operation, wasn't it?
It was, I suppose, yes. I mean, I always, let's say, defended this. What a library is for, they're to get information to people. His job is getting information to people remotely. You do it by the most efficient way possible. Now, it's not a factory, because factories deal with large numbers of small number of items. Boston Spa was dealing with huge numbers of individual items, which is very, very different. It requires more skill and so on. And he devised simple systems, he did what librarians said, and I was agreeing with him, let's cut through all the lot and use simple systems. I'm sorry to say some have been complicated since. Some of the British Library, the books are no longer in alphabetical order, Boston Spa, they're now catalogued and shelved in a traditional way, which seems to be absolutely mad.
Yes, and that was one of his innovations, was to get away from all that.
That's absolutely right, because you can go straight to the shelves with the most requests. But I do know why it's changed, because trying to make more integration between London and Boston Spa, which I never agree with either. I was all for any agglomeration, but I was all for great freedom as well. Now, instances like ICI tried to run it all from the centre. They found they couldn't. They had to disintegrate again, as it were, decentralise. My image of Boston Spa was, had 800 staff around up there. The image of it was of a country where everybody had some national feeling, but you had regions and villages, and each village had some autonomy. They related to the counties, and they related to each other. But you must have some local freedom. You must have freedom. You must have job satisfaction. I brought a job satisfaction expert to look at delegation and so on. That's interesting too, because we had two or three near-nurse breakdowns. What you're doing, you see, you're giving the junior ones more power and status, and they finally do things they didn't think they could do. You're simplifying work, and their media bosses, why am I here? What are we doing? A, I haven't been managing my staff. B, I'm unnecessary. It's a devastating message. And whenever I worked as a consultant on this kind of thing, I found the same thing happening. I always find jobs for these people to begin with. I make you do a wish list. What would you really like to do? All the time and money in the world. Always nobody talking about this much. See, yes, it is. Let's put it down. We forget about it for a year. Let's put it down. And then a year or two later, when they find out of a job, so, well, look at all these things you want to do. You can do them well. And they can. It's all happened quite painlessly.
So, I mean, this is the way of dealing with that middle level of stuff.
Yeah. But, I mean, you have to motivate you. But you probably want to don't talk about management. It's not your topic. But it's why I said case of interest in how to motivate people to do very boring jobs. Not to work at bottom spa, it's very routine and boring. Something like factory work. And we have to give these people satisfaction. And I think we created a very happy atmosphere there. Mm-hmm. You've been down there?
No, I haven't. Mm-hmm.
But everybody says, you know, it still is, I think, a really very happy atmosphere there. Yeah. People got a fair amount of freedom, you know, they work in teams and so on. And nobody's bullied, they all have some contribution made to the place and so on. No one knows what's going on.
So, of course, during your period there, the online revolution was
revolution. Yeah, of course, we had webinars as well, with Centre for Memoirs in the UK, which Tony Hardy was running. And, yes, that started off. So we use automation, but cautiously. You see, you can't automate the whole thing until everything's digitised. There's no way you can automate the retrieval of a book from the shelves.
No.
Well, you can do a kind of Delft system and have a mechanical retrieval system that terribly cumbersome and expensive, and on a huge scale it would be quite out of the question.
Well, given the size of the
But the whole thing was run systematically. I mean, Herbert was quite right about that. And the high-use stuff was in the high-use store and so on. Everything was organised according to statistics in a sense.
Mm.
But that was for serving people. It wasn't for fun or because of statistics for fun, but it was just to serve people.
What was the study that you were referring to that Herbert did?
It's numerous studies, actually.
Mm.
His great discovery was that the books most wanted Life 11 were the ones most commonly held by libraries. Which nobody else. People were still denying this years after the bottom, so it can't be true, these are everywhere. Yeah, but they're the most wanted, and why are they most wanted? Because the libraries can't supply the bloody things, because they're so busy. And, well, A, they're too busy, and B, they're out on loan or whatever.
Mm.
But they can't do it. Lynn Bindley, who was just taking over the BL, the chief executive, she wants to discuss the future of us as well, which is quite right. You've got to be very, very careful, because if she wouldn't do that, I know, couldn't do it. But suppose, for example, you scrap Boston Spa, there's no way universities could absorb that demand. Absolutely no way at all. Overwhelmed, they couldn't do it.
But also, Boston Spa has become quite a revenue provider, hasn't it, for the BL?
It recovers all the transaction costs from UK libraries. UK prices are set to recover the cost of transaction, not the cost of acquisitions. Foreign service is priced to make a profit.
Mm.
I brought it up from 22% of the cost recovery to 60% in my time there, quite deliberately, because I wanted more self-sufficient.
Mm.
And it only stuck. It can't get much higher.
Mm.
Mind you, in the costs were included in the building. We were paid rent for that building. So if you took away those, it was much higher than 60%.
5 minutes.
Okay.
Right.
I'm just trying to think, what are they calling that, the service now, the online service by which you initiate loans and things? What is that?
Well,
I was looking at it recently through the web, in the cost centre, you know, the...
there are various systems. There's, my memory is not what it was. I can't think. I use it myself as a user, actually. I'm a user of Boston Spa.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big change, which happened after I went. We used to sell only CDs, not individuals, who we didn't want to bypass their local libraries. Also, it meant a lot of requests were coming in, would have come in, completely disorganised. I mean, if I said Tom, Dick and Harry to use the place, then the requests were all kinds of nonsense. But with the gain online system, they got quality references. And so that's changed. So, as far as possible, I'm a company using it.
Right.
Yeah, it's one much.
Well, I was curious, talking to Nathalie Dussoulier in France, about the sort of potential competition between what they were trying to do in CNRS and what BL was doing on a much grander scale. And I wondered if you had any comment on this apparent international competition for some of the surgeons in the DL?
Well, there is international competition. Musselsfar at the moment has got a huge portion of international demand, as far as we can tell, a high percentage. Sidetracked slightly, BLC is fusion digitization, but until everything is produced in digital form, which won't be for quite a long time, they'll have to use hard copy. Of course, you can digitize a hard copy and use that afterwards, but you've got copyright problems, and also you've got double process. And so, haven't got stuck. They've been working at it 4 or 5 years and haven't got near as far as they thought they would have done by now. So they will transmit things digitally, but it's a long, hard going. They're in on the beginning of the credentialing system, because I was going lost into that. And then again, it's useful, but it isn't the answer.
Well, again, it covers only a proportion of
that's right, literature. The biomedical stuff.
Right.
I've just written a paper on national acquisition system, saying that it'd be a waste of time.
In what way?
Well, we don't need them. We want international acquisition systems. It doesn't matter where things are. It won't in the future. It won't for journals, certainly. It doesn't matter now for journals. For scientific journals, it hardly matters. Because the physical location of electronic documents is irrelevant.
The assumption is that they will be available electronically.
Well, most scientific ones are. Where they are, they. Most science journals are available electronically.
Many of them are. So print versions are still being. I mean, I think you yourself.
Print versions are still being used. Yeah.
Discuss this.
As far as local level is concerned, yes, that's another matter. As far as national provision is concerned, we ought to agree to national provision. I mean, in the national acquisition policy, think of ones for Britain where you try and coordinate the acquisition of books. Logistic problems are horrific. And you're really asking one university, a Sewage University, to buy books it doesn't need on the prospect that somebody else might want them somewhere else in the future. It's crazy. You can't predict foreign producer demand anyway. It's a complete waste of time and effort. There'll be lots of attempts, they're all broken down.
I see that.
The farm to plan broke down, and lots of it's broken down. Scandinavian ones, the Scandinavian plan broke down. But they all break down, except that's the very small ones. What we ought to aim at in Europe is having all major European catalogues online, most of them are already now, and to allow us to supply things quickly. We don't need a British system. I mean, the effort's much greater than the cost.
But presumably, there's still a role for the VL lending division.
Well, there's older stuff. There's older stuff, and of course, it's one of the major European libraries at the moment, with all supply which British Library London can't. It was an absolute backstop, then if used in the library. That's how the PhD leads at the moment. He's got some stuff on loan from the British Library in London. He's not got his Leeds University Library, but he has a nuisance, really. So he doesn't do it very much. He does much of his work in the flat narrative. Where's the work now? He doesn't use it that good. There's still a role, but there'll be a diminishing role. Where the future boss inspires, I simply don't know. Why that's got to be handled to tremendous care, otherwise they could find themselves in their mess. Also, a question of credibility of this library, because one of the good things about it has been much more user-oriented. Most libraries, national libraries, most of the national libraries are completely scholar-oriented or library-oriented, not user-oriented at all. The BL has been far more, the science rep has been in London, and also the bureaucratic services. My last 3 years in the BL, I was also in charge of the science rep's library in London.
That's interesting.
Which was another interesting thing.
But was Microfield left there by then?
Let me tell you a story, not for repetition.
fascinating.
Let's go back to the beginning. I was a working class child. My father was a postman. Had a scholarship at a public school, better school, and a scholarship in classics to Oxford. Now, classics was accidental because my best subject at school was mathematics. But the headmaster was short of classicists, so I was forced to do classics instead, which in fact was very good for me, otherwise I'd be a very narrow mathematician, I think. But my interest is still very much scientific and numerical. But in addition to this, as a personal history, I had a very bad stammer from the age of 3 to about 23, and it made me rather withdrawn and shy, obviously, because you can't communicate with people. I thought of myself as a born introvert. Also, my mother died when I was 8, which probably made me feel insecure as well. And so when I went up to Oxford, I didn't feel at all sure of myself or who I was. And it took me some time to find out. I found out some of it at Oxford, some of it later. Anyway, I started working. I thought of becoming a lecturer, but then with a stammer, I felt I couldn't. So I started taking a menial job at the Bodleian Library and started doing a DPhil on, of all things, an 8th century manuscript of Boethius, I think it was, with Anglo-Saxon gloss in the margin, because I had equal qualifications as Anglo-Saxon classics. I got bored on my mind with this, interested in the library side of it. I went from there to Glasgow University Library, and by this time I'd forgotten about being a lecturer, and my stammer went. Maybe marrying my wife helped. It gradually went.
So you had no special treatment for that? It just disappeared?
I had treatment when I was about 17, but it didn't have any effect at the time. It just taught me to relax, which has been useful since. But it just went. It comes back occasionally, but I forget about it. I suddenly discovered I wasn't introverted at all. I was quite buoyant and aggressive and extrovert, and things went on from there. But then things took another dip, because I went to South Africa University Library, where there's a mad librarian, and she really was, I can say this now, she's dead. We wished her dead many times. Miss Henderson, Marjorie Henderson. She drifted into the job during the war when it was very small, and said never really wanted it. But she was an absolute bitch of the unspeakable order. She was really unspeakable. And we didn't communicate with her except by memo. We hardly ever saw her. There are some amusing moments. For example, I remember sitting in a meeting once, and one of my colleagues, Alec Anderson, who went to Harry Royal University, had his legs crossed. It, Mr. Anderson, what do you mean I'm crossing your legs? I can see your knee above the table. You know, it was like working in the madhouse. Anyway, to our great astonishment and surprise, she retired at the age of 55, having worn herself out by antagonising everybody else in the university. And we couldn't hold our straight our joy. We didn't show it to manifest, I hope. By this time, I was, 32? She was succeeded by Beres Bland from Birmingham University, whom I owe my career to, in a sense. He wasn't a dynamic boss. He had no ideas. He wasn't a good speaker. He never wrote anything. He never contributed to information science at all. He was a fantastic boss. Why? Because he enabled us before that word came into management use. He gave us freedom. He gave us our head. He coordinated. He was a real chairman, a leader. And I came absolutely alive then. We all did. But I think it affected me most of all. Positively shot up in the library, and we started. This was the days when automation began to come in. I went into that like a duck into water, partly because of interest in mathematics in the past, I suppose.
System studies too.
System studies.
Were you involved in system studies?
I got involved in them as well. Yes. We started. We did one of the first studies of student attitudes to the library, where I taught myself certain amount of statistics, and got involved. I started writing. And discovered I wasn't too bad at it. And inevitably, when you start writing, you start speaking. People ask you to talk. I discovered I wasn't bad at that either. And then I went as a deputy to Newcastle, where automation was really taking off. We automated the acquisition system, the first automated acquisition system anywhere in Britain. And we automated the catalogue as well. Could have been done better, but it was done anyway.
And these were in-house systems, I take it?
In-house systems. They're all done in-house. Man named Nigel Cox did a lot of work on it. He recently died, actually. He wasn't in the library and computer department. I was virtually running Newcastle. I was only deputy there, but the librarian was a lazy sod and everything at all, so I had to run the library, otherwise nothing would happen at all. And so I really got interested in management there, how to motivate staff, how to give them freedom. Had two old ladies in the acquisition department. I thought, my God, how am I going to get them to automate? But I said, well, what's wrong with the present system? How can we improve it? And so they specified, what would you really like to do? So I think automation can help you do that. And so we loved each other after about 3 or 4 months of this, you know, and I never had any problems whatever. They're both over 60. And they're fantastic ladies. It was marvelous. And then I went to Bath University where I had a free hand. Because in ex-technology universities, as they were ex-CATs, the running of the library left the librarians. Academics didn't tell you what to do.
CATs are?
College of Arts Technology. They're not quite universities, but more than colleges. It was one of the, about nine at the time, these great universities, and I just went there when it became university. And again, we automated the catalogue, and I learned more about management, and we did a lot of things there. We started the catalogue research, which ended in the library management, I think Morgan Dempsey's been running, he's just retired from it, he's left and got another job. But the really catalogue systems, a series of cataloguing systems which lasted over 20 years.
These were the
at based at Bath. Mm-hmm. And they developed out of what I started, but I don't claim much credit, I merely got them started. They developed under Philip Bryant and then Morgan Dempsey. Mm-hmm. But he's done a tremendous job and triggered that off. And then I went to the National Central Library, and from there, in its closing days, I went to Boston Spa, because I had sympathy with what Erica was doing, and to go from his reins. I hadn't studied Erica for years, I succeeded him. We already had a research unit there, I increased that, and we did a lot of studies of use and comparing with citations and so on, and distributions, and I asked to do a piece of obsolescence for JDoc, which I did with Sanderson and then Science Reference Library, which has become a classic in the obsolescence work.
So, Morris, I think,
working under Marge Henderson in Southampton, I realised that what she was doing wasn't what people wanted. The library was almost unusable. So I thought, well, looking at life from a user's point, how do you design it? So I began thinking, how do you design libraries around users, not redesign people to fit libraries? And that's affected my career, my whole thinking has been based on this. Also, I tried to unify the highly statistical, methodical thinking, systematic thinking, using every piece of technology and statistical equipment available to serve users. So integrating the human, if you like, with the theoretical.
It's interesting that sort of idea is now animating the development of the computer-based system.
Absolutely.
In a way that it did not before.
Absolutely. Well, I wrote a piece of proceedings, again, about a couple of years ago, on designing life. What I want of a library, how to design libraries around users. And the same applies to computer systems, but it's motivated nearly all my thinking since. So on the one side, the technical, statistical, on the other side, the social, serving people, finding out how people work, what they want, what they think. And that motivated a lot of these social science studies, because I was not satisfied that much of what applied to sciences applied to social sciences. They were getting left out in the cold. And so I got a grant from Austin, as it was then, to do this series of studies on social scientists' need, not only researchers, also practitioners.
Did you have trouble getting the grant from Austin? Because this would be quite new. There would be one that worked on the sciences.
Well, I didn't have much trouble because it was so new and there were no competitors. So I didn't have much trouble getting on. And then this developed into this is the science based system in social sciences. There's a lot more studies, including studies of citations before they're all automated. If you follow each and now, we can do this all manually.
And on cards?
Yeah, well, they're on punch cards, yeah. And this produced some interesting material on how social sciences relate to each other, how they're dependent on each other. For example, anthropology is highly dependent on economics, psychology and everything else, but economics is almost self-sufficient. It may in fact be a sort of sign of maturity of a science that becomes more self-dependent. On the other hand, it may be a sign that boundaries are breaking down, which is in physics and chemistry, and they're getting more integrated.
Yeah.
But you can read all kinds of things into this. Out of this, I made some practical proposals which were taken up.
Remind us of what they were.
Well, really, designing social science information systems to serve people. For example, one study we did was into the optimal pattern of frequency and coverage. Because if you produce something once a week, it's going to be too thin. People put in their waste baskets on the side. If you produce it once every 3 months, it's going to be too big. They're not going to use it because it's too big.
So what's the optimal pattern? And we made some, we did some practical operational research studies on that. Bill Arms actually did those, who we know, of course. Do you know Bill Arms?
No.
Bill Arms? Do you know William Y. Arms?
No.
He, bit off on it.
I don't know that being a professor of computer science at Cornell is a sideline mask.
Well, I think it's one of his jobs, actually. He is a professor there, but I think it's not his main job, actually.
Mm.
You know, I don't think it was. Last time he contacted me. We keep in touch, but...
So he helped you with the...
Well, he did the operational research part of that.
Mm.
Which I was obviously a favour because I was supervising a whole lot.
Mm.
Anyway, there's some practical proposals there which weren't used. But also the whole question of... there are far too many so-called abstract indexing journals. There's a lot of overlap. But we found they had to use about five or six to get reasonable coverage, in 90% coverage, unlike sciences where you've got the huge ones like Chemabs and so on. And what they ought to have done really is to amalgamate, integrate, coordinate or whatever. None of this happened, of course. Some of them were hand-to-mouth things, you know, shoestring efforts. Some of the very big ones, I search for abstracts, but they help a lot. And they're still a very efficient system.
Is this related to psychabs and sociological abstracts, historical abstracts too?
Yeah, it's on the verge of social science, I'll be concerned. But there are three or four economic ones, for example.
Mm.
I'm out of touch with this, but you know, the situation is still bad.
Mm. Back then, as a result of these studies, you made some proposals that, they might change coverage and so on.
Yeah.
These were not taken up. Let's not talk about the ones...
The only way we're getting them taken up, actually, was for a public sector body or one, a not-for-profit organisation, to outdo them. You weren't going to get the existing ones to amalgamate, but you could have one that started a new one, resourcing or dancing and not rest out of existence. It's the only way it could happen.
A bit unrealistic because of the competition with the... I mean, if you take things like PsychAds and the professional societies that are supporting journals of that kind, it's very hard to get them...
And there's nothing economics parallel with those.
Say again?
Nothing economics or sociology parallel with the reference psychological association, whether it is, or the...
Well, sociological abstracts too, I think, is...
Nothing like the size of the science
one. It's fairly well established, I think.
Yeah.
But anyway, I mean, it's interesting that right then, I mean, that in a sense there was this competitiveness that wouldn't allow them to come together in some reasonable...
Well, they make it, a profit, or be a small one. Mm. They either make it a profit and we didn't want to drop it, or there were lectures doing on a huge thing at the university. They were making no profit, because they were running kudos.
Mm.
Either way, you weren't going to get them giving it up until they retired or had to.
Mm. So, then
there's nothing in anthropology economics parallel to the American Psychological Society or Biological Association and so on. ACS and so on, nothing parallel with that at all. If there had been, I think they could have done something about it.
So, these studies then, you did the INPROS studies and then the DIS study, one following the other in a sense, naturally. And at what point then did you left Bath?
Well, INFOS started at Bath. It was finished off when I was at Boston Spa.
Oh, was it? Okay.
And it overlapped a bit with DISIS, which also... Now, INFOS, I got the grant at Newcastle, that's right. We started at Newcastle. And more or less finished at Bath. Then DISIS started with a bit of overlap. DISIS started at Bath and finished 3 or 4 years into my Boston Spa time. Okay. By that time, I was much too busy doing other things to pursue it.
Yeah. Did you have somebody that could take over that role?
Well, Matt Britton, of course, was the first primary researcher on DISIS, who's now in New Zealand.
Yeah, mind you. Yes, and he was, he was physically located at Bath.
Yeah, right. It's really what made his career.
Yeah.
Because he was a psychology lecturer, so I don't know how I pulled him in.
Mm. Mm. Yes, he did that book on, which is a survey of the literature essentially.
That's right, yeah. And he done one or two books on it.
Yeah.
Okay. But he really owes his whole career to that beginning. One of my great joys in the career is seeing other people develop.
Mm.
Like Philip Bryant, for example, was a rather shy, awkward, not shy on the word, slightly gauche, non-graduate, inexperienced ex-public librarian at Bath. He really came into his own completely. I mean, he made a different man entirely, but he wanted to catch up with his thing.
Well, he then made his reputation as a consequence of seeing William.
Exactly, yeah.
Because of his...
niceness to say this in public all the time. It's very satisfying to see people grow. And there's a bottom spire, over 1,000 staff under me in the British Library. I knew about three after my forename. But watching some of them grow and helping them grow without them knowing it, I think, in most cases, was very satisfying.
Tell me something about Urquhart and your association with him and potentially following him into that position as director.
He had a one-track mind. I mean, he was a most uninteresting man. He could talk about almost nothing. He's a Boston spy, a great egotist. I mean, he's an achievement there. He wrote these two books, which are not actually good. I was asked to referee one of them for an American publisher. I said, in fairness to Urquhart, please don't publish it. It won't do any good. Benjamin's used them quite a bit for his work. There's some good stuff in them, but they're so egotistic all the time. I did this, I did that. He was a great bully. He appointed lots of yes men. And when I became boss, I had my first staff meeting, and they sat there and said, well, I want your opinion. So we're waiting for yours. And I said, well, I'm not Urquhart, so I'm on his line. I want yours, you're being well paid. We're going to work together. I'm not going to boss you around. And some of them never learned. Some of them just couldn't. And some of them really burst out in a great. But some of them, including my deputy Keith Barr, who died 3 years ago, he just couldn't change. He used to. He was a marvellous deputy in the sense, whatever you asked him to do, he'd do it superbly. But never a spark on his own, not a spark initiative. Also no human warmth either. Very interesting. But it's very interesting because I had two jobs, one making Boston Spa humane, and it couldn't have lasted as Urquhart was running it. He ran like a dictatorship. Unions were getting restless. Styles were changing, attitudes were changing. It couldn't have lasted as he was running it. But the other main task was integrating the National Central Library and the NLL with totally different traditions. And that was interesting too.
But your coming from the National Central Library must have been a great help in that respect.
It was a help, yes. I understood both sides. And I gave support, not too much support, to the National Central Library staff. Many of them stayed behind in London, so not all my many came up actually. But those that did, some still didn't do with them. But it wasn't the people slash the traditions, getting two cultures going together. I reckon in a year we cracked it, in 2 years, and no problem at all. It was seamless.
Well, when Urquhart set it up, I mean, it was really very much a kind of factory operation, wasn't it?
I suppose, yes. I mean, I always, I would say, defended this. What a library is for, they're to get information to people. His job is getting information to people remotely. You do it by the most efficient way possible. Now, it's not a mail order, it's not a factory, because factories deal with large numbers of small number of items. Boston Spa was dealing with huge numbers of individual items, which is very, very different. It requires more skill and so on. And he devised simple systems, he'd all my librarians say, and I was agreeing with him, but let's cut to all off on use simple systems. I'm sorry to say something complicated since some reason the British Library, the books are no longer in alphabetical order, Boston Spa, they're now catalogued and shelved in a traditional way, which seems to me absolutely mad.
Yes, and that was one of his innovations, was to get away from all of
it. Absolutely right, because you can go straight to the shelves with the most requests. I do know why it's changed, because trying to make more integration between London and Boston Spa, which I never agree with either. I was all for any agglomeration, but I was all for great freedom as well. Now, instances like ICI tried to run it all from the centre. They found they couldn't. They had to disintegrate again, as it were, decentralise. My image of Boston Spa was, had 800 staff around it there. Image of it was of a country where everybody had some national feeling, but you had regions and villages, and each village had some autonomy. They related to the counties, and they related to each other. But you must have some local freedom. You must have freedom. You must have job satisfaction. I brought in a job satisfaction expert to look at delegation and so on. That's interesting too, because we had two or three near-nurse breakdowns. And what you're doing, you see, you're giving the junior ones more power and status, and they finally do things they can do. You're simplifying work, and then meet your bosses. Why am I here? What have I been doing? A, I haven't been managing my staff, B, I'm unnecessary. It's a devastating message. And whenever I worked as a consultant on this kind of thing, I found the same thing happening. I always find jobs for these people to begin with. I make them do a wish list. What would you really like to do? All the time and money in the world. What are we talking about this month? See, yes, it is. Let's put it down. We forget about it for a year. Let's put it down. And then a year or two later, when they find out of a job, say, well, look at all these things you want, you can do them well. And they can. It's all happened quite painlessly.
So, I mean, this is a way of dealing with that middle level of stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to motivate you. But you probably don't talk about management, it's not your topic. But it's why I said, okay, so interested in how to motivate people to do very boring jobs. Not to work at Boston Spa, was very routine and boring. Something like factory work. And we have to give these people satisfaction. And I think we created a very happy atmosphere there. Mm-hmm. You've been out there.
No, I haven't.
But everybody says, you know, it still is, I think, a really very happy atmosphere there. Mm-hmm. People got a fair amount of freedom, you know, they work in teams and so on. And nobody's bullied, they all have some contribution made to the place and so on. No one knows what's going on.
So, of course, during your period there, the online revolution was called revolution.
Yeah, of course, we had webinars as well, the Centre for Memoirs in the UK, which Tony Hardy was running. And, yes, I started on. We use automation, but cautiously. You see, you can't automate the whole thing until everything's digitized. There's no way you can automate the retrieval of books for the shows.
No.
But you can do a kind of Delft system and have a mechanical retrieval system that totally cumbersome and expensive, and on a huge scale it'd be quite out of the question.
Given the size of the
But the whole thing was run systematically. I mean, Open was quite right about that, and the high use stuff was an high use store and so on, and everything was organised according to statistics in a sense.
Mm.
But that was for serving people, it wasn't for fun, or because of statistics for fun, but it just served people.
What was the study that you were referring to that Urquhart did? And that,
numerous studies, actually. Mm. His great discovery was that the books most wanted at Library 11 were the ones most commonly held by libraries. Which nobody ever... And people were still denying this years after the Boston, so it can't be true, these are everywhere. Yeah, but they're the most wanted. And why are they most wanted? Because the libraries can't supply those bloody things, because they're so busy. And, well, A, they're too busy, and B, they're out on loan or whatever.
Mm.
But they can't do it. Lynn Bindley, who's just taking over the BL, the chief executive, she wants to discuss the future of loss as well, which is quite right. You've got to be very, very careful, because if she wouldn't do that, I know, couldn't do it. But suppose, for example, you scrap Boston Spa, there's no way universities could absorb that demand, absolutely no way at all. They're overwhelmed, they couldn't do it.
But also, Boston Spa has become quite a revenue provider, hasn't it, for the BL?
It recovers all the transaction costs from UK libraries. UK prices are set to recover the cost of the transaction, not the cost of acquisitions. Foreign service is priced to make a profit.
Mm.
I bought it up from 22% of the cost recovery to 60% during my time there, quite deliberately, because I wanted more subsidies.
Mm.
And there it stuck. It can't get much higher.
Mm.
Mind you, the costs were included in the building. We were paid rent for that building. So if you took away those, it was much higher than 6%.
5 minutes.
Okay.
All right.
I'm just trying to think, what are they calling that, the service now, the online service by which you initiate loans and things? What is that? I was looking at it recently through the web, in the cost centre, you know, the...
There are various systems. There's, my memory is not what it was. I can't think. I use it myself as a user, actually. I'm a user of Boston Spa.
Mm-hmm.
That was a big change, which happened after I went. We used to sell only students, not individuals, who we didn't want to bypass their local libraries. Also, it meant a lot of requests were coming in, would have come in, completely disorganized. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I said Tom, Dick and Harry to use the place, there would be requests for all kinds of nonsense. But with, again, online systems, they got quality references. So that's changed. So as far as possible, I'm a company using it. Yeah, it's one much.
Well, I was curious, talking to Nathalie Dussoulier in Frank, about the sort of potential competition between what they were trying to do in CNRS and what BL was doing on a much grander scale. And I wondered if you had any comment on this parent international competition for some of the services in the BL.
Well, there is international competition. Brussels at the moment has got a huge proportion of international demand, as far as we can tell, a high percentage. Sidetrack slightly, BLC is fusion digitization, but until they're introducing digital form, which will be quite a long time, they'll have to use hard copy. Of course, you can digitize the hard copy and then use that afterwards, but you've got copyright problems, and also you've got a double process. And so, haven't got stuck. They've worked out 4 or 5 years and haven't got near as far as they thought they would have done by now. So they will transmit things digitally, but it's a long, hard going. They're really on the beginning of the identity system, because I was going off into that. And then again, it's useful, but it isn't the answer.
Well, again, it covers only a proportion of
that's right,
the literature.
Biomedical stuff.
Yeah.
I've just written a paper on national acquisition system, saying that would be a waste of time.
In what way?
Well, we don't need them. We want international acquisition systems. It doesn't matter where things are. It won't in the future. It won't for journals, certainly. It doesn't matter now for journals. For scientific journals, it hardly matters. Because the physical location of electronic documents is irrelevant.
Well, the assumption is that they will be available electronically.
Well, most scientific ones are. Ready, aren't they? Most science journals are available in electronic form.
Many of them are. Print versions are still being. I mean, I think you yourself.
Print versions are still being used. Yeah, yeah.
Discuss this.
As far as local relevance is concerned, yes, that's another matter. As far as national provision is concerned, we ought to think of international provision. I mean, national acquisition policies. Think of ones for Britain where you try and coordinate acquisition of books. Logistic problems are horrific. And you're really asking one university, a serious university, to buy books it doesn't need on the prospect that somebody else might want them somewhere else in the future. It's crazy. You can't predict forward the producer demand anyway. It's a complete waste of time and effort. There'll be lots of attempts, they're all broken down.
I see that.
The farming to plan broke down, there's lots of things broken down. Scandinavian plan broke down. But they all break down, except that's the very small ones. What we ought to aim at in Europe is having all major European catalogues online, most of them are already now, and to allow us to supply things quickly.
Mm.
We don't have any system. I mean, the effort is much greater than the cost.
Mm. But presumably there's still a role for the BL lending division.
Well, there's all the nationally. Stuff. And there's all the stuff, and of course this is one of the major European libraries at the moment, with all supply which British Library of London can't, or well, it was an absolute backstop, then if you use in the library, that's as the PhD leads at the moment. He's got some stuff on loan from the British Library in London. He's not got his Leeds University Library, but he has a nuisance really. He doesn't do it very much, he does much of his work in the flat and narrow room. Where's the work now? There's still a role, but there'll be a diminishing role. Where the future Brussels spies, I simply don't know. Why that's got to be handled with tremendous care, otherwise they could find themselves in a mess. Also, a question of credibility of this library, because one of the good things about it has been much more user oriented. Most libraries, national libraries, most of the national libraries are completely scholar oriented or librarian-oriented, they're not user oriented at all. The BL has been far more, the science ref has been in London, and also the bureaucratic services. My last 3 years in the BL, I was also in charge of the science ref site in London.
Well, that's interesting.
Which was another interesting thing.
But was Michael Hill left there by then?
Let me tell you a story, not for repetition.
think massage is a whole different question, but I mean, you asked the question, you were interested in where do we go from here. It seems to me that you don't really know where you are unless you have some historical sense.
That's right. Yes, I've got enough of that.
Mm.
But I'm not interested. Some people seem to dwell in the past all the time, particularly when they get older. And I'm not interested. I'm interested in where we are, maybe how we got here, and then where we go from here.
Mm. Well, let me ask you the question. Where do we go from here?
I don't know. I suppose I could cop out and say everybody should find their own solution. The first thing is they should ask the right questions. Many of them are not doing. How can we defend our present patch? How can we keep libraries as they are? To me, that's an irrelevant question. What's society going to look like in 10, 20 years' time? How can we react to it? What are going to be economic, social changes? And for example, let's look at immigration, which is way away from that. It isn't like way from that basic at all. A massive immigration is going to occur. It's going to be far more pressure because the population in developed countries is declining, more stable. Population in developing countries is increasing all the time. There's going to be huge immigration pressure, as there were in the Middle Ages and past history. These are necessary because we've got an aging population and we need younger people and we need immigrants in. I mean, in Britain, the health service and the transports would break down if we didn't have immigrants. The entire nurses and almost entirely black of all colours.
Mm.
You know, it's incredible. In enormous degree, these had to be educated, assimilated, and so on. They affect public libraries in particular, and public libraries have reacted, on the whole, fairly well to them. You know, things like this cannot be ignored with libraries, with library services. And we're going to have enormous economic disturbances in the future as well. You know, looking ahead to the future is... Horace Walpole said, life is a tragedy to him a field, a comedy to him a things. But I do both at different times. And if I feel about it, I think, my God, where are we going? I think about it, how fascinating, it's really interesting. Hope be alive 150 years' time, something what's happening. And you were wrong. But you have to do some planning for the future, and you can make reasonable projections 10, 15 years ahead, I think, on the grounds of social changes.
Coming back to the information services, not necessarily libraries, but the broader question of the various systems for the dissemination of information that have been set up, many of which are held by professional associations, many of which are becoming increasingly market-driven and held by the commercial interests.
Yeah.
Where do you see the future going for these?
Great dangers, of course. The libraries get left to sweep up the uneconomic. One big factor, by the way, is that one big trend in individualization, which automation has increased, of course. People expect individual service now in shops elsewhere. And so this is affecting information services enormously. People are not content with a mass service, take it or leave it. They want the individual services, which are now possible where they weren't 10 years ago. And I think there's a big market niche of people which libraries can't even fulfill. It would be very hard for libraries to give individualised service in the way that, say, a private company could.
Is that because the private company requires you to pay for what it is that you get?
Partly that. Partly, they're much more flexible, you can react much more quickly.
Why shouldn't libraries be able to be flexible and act more quickly?
Public service constraints, staff, you can't sack your staff. If they're say conservative and stuck in the past, you can't sack them all. You can't recruit new staff quickly, you certainly can't if you recruit them at all. Restraints on budgets, you know, and if I were in a public library, I might say this staff's all bloody day that's stuck 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Let's get rid of them and get 10 new ones. You can't. Private sector I probably could, well, not easily, but you can do it. I mean, there's that kind of problem as well. The bosses are stuck. Many of them are too old to change, they don't want to change. Many bosses I've worked with, as a consultant, you know, say, well, I suppose this is coming, Morris, will be after my time. Maybe when I retire in 5 years' time, well, God help us.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I think the staff inflexibility is one of the big problems. The inertia of any public sector organisation, the constraints on finance, the constraints imposed by the committees you're responsible to. Because many library committees are more conservative than librarians. You don't know Sir Colin Campbell, the UBC at Nottingham, do you? He's got on to everything. You think he knows everything, knows everybody. He's a big bully of a man. He's a little bully of a man. But he called me in because he was concerned about the library, which was spending a high percentage on staff and other university libraries in the UK. Well, I found out the reasons for this very quickly. One of the reasons was that they had three main libraries to manage, which is expensive for staff. The second was they're spending less on libraries as a whole. The less you spend, the more percentage you spend on staff, obviously. I thought it's not the reason why, I said, well, I'm sorry if you started anyway. And my first reason was, my view is that libraries are very conservative places. In my experience, vice chancellor, they're less conservative than the universities are. He didn't like at all.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was quite funny because I'd been working for about a year. He said, Morrison, staff at this university say they're concerned about morale. I can't understand this at all. I said, well, if you wanted to, you could bring in a consultant I worked with, a very experienced public safety consultant, who's worked, invented the German job search back years ago, and get him spend a day. He said, well, so he brought in Keith Robinson, and Keith spent a day and a half talking with the staff. I said, well, I'd like to call a meeting of any staff to come with you present, like, if I can. So he got them all the elected. Vice Chancellor, you brought me in to look at the discontent among staff and low morale. And after talking to staff, Vice Chancellor, I have to say a lot of responsibility lies with yourself.
Oh.
Had no effect on it at all. As thick as skin as anything comes. There's no effect whatever.
And did he change the system? Or
no,
he just kept on going.
No, he didn't understand it.
Mm.
It's the staff's fault, not his.
Mm.
It couldn't possibly be his fault. I just hear Keith saying this. So he's a very calm, cool, very slow manner. So it's actually dynamic. Wish I'd be there. Anyway. No, I think conservatism is a natural thing, isn't it? None of us like change if it disturbs our lives.
Mm.
If somebody told me to move house tomorrow, I'd hate it.
I can certainly accept
that. It's very easy to look around and see how other people can change their systems. Change one's own, it doesn't matter.
Mm.
As a consultant, I feel privileged. If I could suggest things I couldn't do myself. Or wouldn't necessarily want to. They still need to be done.
Mm.
So I think there are a lot of inhibitions in the public sector. There are ways of dealing with it. I mean, I think the issue in the BL with the public library network is terrific. That will have a real impact. I think the government's doing a terrific job here, as in many other spheres which are not recognised. But there are some public libraries who don't want to know. I think of 4 or 5, you know, I don't know them all well now. 4 or 5 I rated actually top rated in Britain. Some are rated bottom rated, and the rest are in the middle, who will move if there's sufficient kick or pull or shove. But they won't otherwise.
Mm.
And as any profession, you get 3 or 4 leaders. How many leaders can you support anyway? And the rest don't follow or not, in the case of me.
You said that you were associated with Engineering Index for quite a while. And I wonder what insight that gave you into what was changing with these sorts of commercial-based services.
Well, managerial is interesting because John McGatsey did things that no librarian could possibly do because of the public sector.
Mm.
And the way he turned that place around in 3 years, no librarian could have done that, possibly. Too many constraints. And, librarians can't borrow money. They can't carry money over 1 year to another, only small amounts. You know, all kinds of constraints. Mm. It used to be there's nothing to the British Library, because they always say, well, you should behave more like the private sector. I will if you can let me. But I cannot do break dancing with hands and feet tied together. I cannot work with the private sector if there's every possible public constraint put in my way. Give me freedom, I'll do better. Give me total freedom over money, I'll give a better service or else. I should be accountable, but give me total freedom. Well, how many staff have you got? How much do they cost? It doesn't matter how many staff I've got. It depends on what service I'm giving. you know, the message getting through the civil service now is very, very slow. And the same with public, I think, any life. They should give them a lump sum and say, this is what we want to do, go ahead and do it. If you don't, how do you go? Mm-hmm. They should be free now to do it.
So the
that would really put them on the special commission.
So Margaret Thatcher's advent was not able to change that approach to the civil service very much.
It's having an effect, but it's very, very slow. But it has an effect, undoubtedly. Mm. I don't know the slightest. Mm. I mean, I have a great dislike for Mrs. Thatcher and all her works, but on the other hand, some of the effects she had were good. I have a theory: there's no bad thing that doesn't have some good results, and vice versa.
She was a bad thing with some good results. Mm. Yeah. Mm.
The bad thing was the huge division between Mission 4 and I said a lot of bad things. But there's some good results from it. On the contrary, I think it's some good things have very bad results and good intentions, which, you know. Public libraries are better than academic libraries because people won't have computers, they won't know how to use them, they will need help. And I think there's a great opportunity with lifelong learning in public libraries to fill that gap. And the government has recognised this, so I think public libraries actually, if they handle things properly, can be onto an absolute winner. University libraries, I'm not sure of. But they still have a traditional function, they're still books to be supplied for a long time ahead, so in a sense there's some time. But I like to have a long-term vision. I think many librarians and other people in the profession, they suffer from short vision and narrow vision, whereas what I want is a long distance lens and a wide angle vision.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can narrow the focus. But until you've got the whole picture, until you can see, imagine. Can't see. Imagine 10, 15 years ahead until you see the whole context in the broad picture. But you can't focus on it because you don't know what to focus on.
Mm.
Otherwise, you focus on your feet, what you're doing.
On the other hand, I mean, achieving such a vision, I mean, to ask the question of you about this, it is so hard to project ahead.
The only way you can do it, I think, is by thrashing out ideas. People are chucking ideas into a pot and seeing there's some convergence between them. I think it's a time for speculation, ideas and so on. And lots of ideas come together. I mean, I'm talking about future education. I think 5 years ago there'd be no consensus at all. The things I've been reading recently by Vice Chancellor and so on, America including, I mean, there's a coming towards a big consensus that huge change is necessary. They're not agreed on how to do it, but they're agreed on what they're doing.
Mm.
So I think there we are reaching consensus. Except the universities aren't reacting to it. Again, because many of them can't, there's too many constraints.
Yes, but some of those constraints are anchored in a vision of what they think the university ought to be, which is not quite, I think...
Is the cop-out in the intellectual laziness?
No, not necessarily, I don't think so. I mean, a lot of the speculation in universities about the transformations that the technology will allow are driven by economic considerations, not broad educational or philosophical views.
Yeah.
And in a way, what's happening is that the higher education system, in a way as I know it, is becoming stratified, where you're having a sort of a mass, and I think eventually could well be an inferior approach that is taken through maybe inappropriate applications of technology, and what is more traditional, that is for essentially a select few. I don't think we yet know that educational, the sort of achievements educationally, through more casual approaches to online education, are really having similar results or is it equally effective as some of the more traditional approaches. That is to say, bringing people together and interacting personally within that complex arrangement that you have in a university in a physical place I'm not sure that we've been able to find the equivalence of that.
I think the physical place is immensely important. There always need to be campuses for people to debate. Much of what I learned in the university was learned not from tutors, but from people in the undergraduate. So the talking shop is essential. Public library as well. So I think the library is a place where people can meet and discuss. It's very important. It needn't be a library, but I do think that thing is important. Also, I think obviously things are technologically driven, but technology can drive music as well. They can support music. They can support art. I mean, they've got this, we can call up a lot of the major galleries in the world now, the computer's great. So it's not only technology, I would guess that the internet and the web has helped people learn more about art and music in the last 5 to 10 years or so.
Oh, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying there's not a major role for it, and as I think there is, but some of the talk that I have heard in the level of vice chancellors is really saying we can now provide through this apparatus a whole educational process that will be cheaper, which we can sell to more people.
All economic technical terms. I'm dead against that.
And without trying to establish, you know, its broad educational and social value, they're thinking in limited economic terms and competing again one institution over another, trying to attract customers. Yeah. So, you know, in our university, the one of the deputy vice chancellors said we must never anymore talk about students. We should talk about customers.
Mm.
And I mean, you can make an argument that that's like saying we must devise systems for users and not but it seems to me that it fundamentally misunderstands who that person is to call the person we normally call a student a customer.
I think this would be counterbalanced in a way by this process of individualization, the onus being very on the student once more, like the medieval university, where students employ lecturers. I mean, I think students will demand what they want. If they don't get it, I think they'll hunt for it. So I think they're countervailing pressures here.
I hope so.
But I agree with you, we don't have anything divided in terms of money. It's divided in terms of that. The people are selfish and greedy, etc., etc., but those people still have some values or other.
And I think that's one reason why there's, at one level, there's a lot of talk, but not a great deal of action. But where the action does occur is where the new technology and its capabilities are clearly able to enhance what's going on. And that's when, you know, access to the web, to look at galleries or the music and so on, you can integrate that into your classroom, into your research at the undergraduate level and so on, fantastically well and creatively.
Well, my whole horse is by integrating libraries and museums, by having sculptures and pictures on the same view as these subjects. Integrate a whole lot and so on. Integrate a whole lot. You can't physically, but you can virtually with a computer.
Yeah. Well, I've made an argument and published one. I'll send you a copy of the paper. In which I talk about just this, that as a consequence of the digitization process, that if you digitize print, images, sound, whatever, but the institutional distinctions that have been required by the physical format disappear, and what you're left with then are essentially the redefinition of the library as a museum, that is, for the physical care of artifacts.
I think the decision in Britain to integrate the libraries, art galleries, and museums in one body. Body is
right.
Some libraries were for it, some against it, because you know, some public libraries are libraries always responsible for art galleries, they're ready, some are not. Some are responsible for cemeteries, even the Oxford Football Leisure. Some ones are responsible for series, so the Oxford for relegation. No, I think things are in a state of flux, and no one can see their way through. I think what I'd like is not just a technical vision, but a human vision, what society would want to be. mean, there are two things really. Where are we going? And that you can predict for about 10 or 15 years, except that even then you get wrong. So there's been tremendous tend towards greed and selfishness. I think there'll be a counteraction to that, you know. Things do have a counteraction. So I think that may not be with us for all that long, because the individual greed doesn't work on the whole, not very much on other people. A, what's going to happen? B, what do you want to happen? And C, how do you change what's going to happen to what you want to happen? You've got to have your personal heavenly city as well as your personal prediction of what's going to happen.
I think it's terribly exciting and interesting. And I think your distinction about it from Horace Walpole about feeling and thinking, I think that's very apt, because all of us, there's a certain nostalgia for the past. And for its certainties and security, and that's being undermined. But the way what is happening is so intriguing. And intolerable. We don't know everything.
So I've got no nostalgia. All I do, I see images of people with arms cut off in Sierra Leone. I weep. They think about how can we get out of the situation. Your intellectual side goes working. I couldn't live without well either, really, because if I had the second only intellectual side of being human, if I had the first side, I'd break down.
Yeah.
Balance. You know, you look at it from various points, psychological, social Darwinism point of view, anthropological point of view, all kinds of point of view. I'm an atheist. I was brought up as a strict Calvinist, by the way, not a factor of my career. And I grew up with painfully and slowly, fighting, getting out of being Jesuit and being painful. But I was saying to a Jewish friend in London the other week, my vision of God, if there is one, is someone playing at a computer game where tribes limit to see how many can shoot, how many limit each other and so on. Just have fun or create a normal human being or a normal animal, see what it looks like, you know, the whole nation totally random. So, well, actually, if you go back to the Jewish Kabbalah in the middle of the Kabbalah in the Middle Ages, one of the heresies was God just not playing computer games, but just doing things for fun. Designing human beings and natures for fun, let's see what happens next. Very interesting. What's the Jewish medieval force? That's extremely interesting. Because some of the heresies there, and some of which Milton incorporated in Paradise Lost, by the way, some of the heresies there are really quite extreme, even by modern standards.
What you see is the system ideal. But we've come a long way from the automatic data processing days through online to the internet.
Yeah. And some of it, of course, is user-oriented, otherwise people wouldn't buy it. I mean, I think there's some ways in which you want a market which isn't necessarily financial. I mean, the concept of a market in life is a good one, I think. Otherwise, you've gone serving nobody at all, accumulating old books, without thinking who they're for and who wants them or not. And again, think of markets as forced by to prioritise services. If they do a market study, a non-financial market study, and they will decide what we really need most. I worked with the Dutch University of Life for a couple, two or three years, and they were giving so nobody wanted for years, and they were, it may be my guess.